Whenever I talk with people, I first ask questions about their childhood. I like to know when you were born and where you are from, but also something about your parents, your mother, your father, what they did, what you remember about them. So let's start with those things.
Yeah, that probably is more relevant. I was born in Osaka, 1936, November 6th. And my parents, I'm the only child, so I was highly spoiled, but my father was a chemical engineer, and so that chemical companies my father used to work was the first company that they made a sulfuric acid with the catalytic method. Before the 1930s, most of the sulfuric acid is made in a lead chamber method. Lead chamber method actually had a lot of contamination with the lead in the sulfuric acid, and also not only that the concentration doesn't go more than 30%. Whereas if you use vanadium oxide method, they can actually have about 98% pure sulfuric acid. And sulfuric acid is very important for all sorts of chemical reactions. If somebody take the organic chemistry, sulfuric acid is all over because it make an ester or to make the dehydration of the reaction, so that many of the organic synthesis requires high quality of the sulfuric acid. That was the most important at that time. And my father's company had a contract, or the collaboration of the contract with a German company, which I don't remember. But for that reason, I was brought up in pretty much a chemical environment. When I was about five, two people were talking about the catalysis and vanadium oxide, the black powder. And that, I think it's very interesting, because that probably triggered me to be a chemist. And the vanadium oxide is nothing really new to me when I was about 6 or 7 years old. And I used to have a German scientist, the German engineer used to come. And
so you mean at your home, you would have a chance to sort of interact
with them?
Oh, yes.
They like a Japanese business. They're just not only the factory, you know, the company based, but we have this personal visits and things like that. And I remember that when I was a kid, I wanted to become a Navy man. So they have the small Navy, the uniforms, and then one time in Osaka, they have German kids actually visited, so we have the exchange in a park, something like this. But I remember that, you know, the most of the time people, German engineer comes, they bring those the German candy. So I was really well endowed with the German candies.
Do you have any recollection of flavors or what candy
It was a little bit too harsh for me, but they have a strawberry flavors and sometimes an orange flavors, and they have a beautiful gold and silver wrappings. So, and my mother used to put that on the entrance of our house, you know, the kind of genkan. And so my friends usually come and grab a couple of this. So I was very popular among them. So
it must have been rare commodity among kids at that time.
Well, because in Osaka in those days, that's kind of interesting place at the Yodogawa. Himeji, the other one, just across the Yodogawa Denpocho, that area was pretty much the factory workers, the areas. There's no big houses, but my father became, I think, a department chief of the unit. So the company, for some security reason, they used to come and pick up my father every morning. And so that was the kind of fun.
Was he around at home to interact with children? I mean,
not really, because he had more often, you know, when he was on the in the factory floors, it's not he used to come home pretty much, you know, regularly.
Mm-hmm.
But then when he was promoted, I think his lifestyle changed quite a bit. He had more parties,
mm-hmm.
the
mm-hmm.
business, you know, dinners and things like that. So my mother and I were the only one usually have. So
mm-hmm.
I have more influence by my mother than by my father, but. Professionally, it's a little bit different.
Uh-huh.
Professionally, I have been actually salty inside the chemical world. So,
uh-huh.
like the containers that they use, they can't have huge bottles of the sulfuric acid.
Uh-huh.
So what they do, the container has the tank, huge tank that has the windows, but the steel is made out of silica iron. The mixture between silicon and iron, that's an alloy type of things. That type of container can hold very strong acid. That type of things I've been known. And from the early days, my father was very strict to me to draw the mechanical drawings.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I have to make a kind of perfect drawing of the compressor.
Yes.
And that was before, you know, I was about 5 or 6 years old.
Very
I
young.
Remember crying, you know, several times because I couldn't make it perfect drawing.
Uh-huh.
But that's what I remember in Osaka.
Osaka. How about your mother? Maybe you can tell me
my
a little
mother,
bit about her.
Yeah, my mother. You know, they actually they helped me a little bit older age. As things I remember is. Whenever I go to schools, and you know, they have the parent teacher dates, and I used to complain my mother saying that, you know, you're too old. You see, my friend's mother is young and beautiful, and my mother was so mad. I remember one incident of that. But my mother, I think, volunteered as a nurse during the. Not the Second World War, but before that, and for some reason, I think I don't really recall my mother's profession. She's not a professional. The mother is a profession itself, so I actually took it for granted. So
mm-hmm.
that's one of the funny part of it.
Mm-hmm. So, do you remember her going out to work during your childhood, or do you remember
my
her
father
mostly
used
around?
To? Yeah, that's interesting. My father used to go to work about 10 o'clock in the morning, and because the chauffeur comes to pick him up, and that's what I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And when he is not actually like the holidays and things like that, we used to go to nearby train station
mm-hmm.
and gather some of the weed for the guinea pig I used to have.
Mm.
And in those days, they used to call the morimoto. So,
mm-hmm.
And I used to have a pet, and we used to get some of the weeds around. So I remember those
mm-hmm.
period.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of my childhood is very happy childhood
uh-huh.
because I'm the only child, and so I have pretty much everything I needed.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
even though one time my mother became sick and has to be hospitalized, and then the company helped to entertain a couple of people from foreign countries, and so they had this big geisha party. So
mm-hmm.
my father had to take me to the geisha party. And in those days, they said, well, you shouldn't be taking kids to geisha parties.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, I was one of the geisha was assigned to me to entertain me. He said, you can go any place and do anything you want. So I said, okay, let's go to a department store. And I remember buying a lot of toys that time in charge to the companies, I think.
That's very nice.
The funny part of it. But mother said, you should be doing something like that. Well, anyhow, that's...
Do you think your mother was professionally trained to be
no,
able to work as a nurse, or
yeah,
was she
my
just...
My mother was... that's what I heard from my relatives.
She had a Red Cross coin.
Huh?
Yeah, the Red Cross coin, the volunteer
coin. Red Cross
coin,
but I don't think it's nothing to do with that. Yeah.
Mm.
My relatives tells me, my grandfather And great-grandfather was a very rich person in Yamaguchi-ken.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to have a sake breweries. They have a good brand name, sake. And my grandfather actually ruined the whole thing, actually. He spent entire things. So by the time my father's time, there is no wealth left much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, however, when my father was young, and she was working in my grandfather's, the grandfather's house or something as a maid, because she came from the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And that was how he met her.
I see.
And then somehow they liked each other, so they actually refused to have omiyai, the traditional way of mm-hmm. Japanese wedding. So that's how they get married. So they, I don't think she had much of the, the professional, and she was able to read and things like that, but that's what I remember. So my mother's background, coming to my grandmother's, it's my mother's side, that was more interesting, so I talk to you more later. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So my childhood wise, I was in Osaka until say about the early Januarys of 1945,
mm-hmm.
because they had a huge air raid, and my house was burned, and then we have no place to go. And prior to that, we had this Denpocho Elementary School. I have to evacuate to the countryside, Ikeda. Right now, it's not Ikeda, it's a big city now. I went to the group evacuations and
mm-hmm.
seeing that the town, the entire city of Osaka is burning.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really scared because I thought that maybe my house was burnt. Actually, that particular time, my house was okay, but.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually my house was burnt. And so evacuation was very interesting because everybody goes into the countryside, the schools, and then they will sleep on the huge assembly halls all together with a sheet of futon and that.
Mm-hmm.
And the food that they have, I still remember, the worst food I had in the evacuation, they had soup made of canned salmon.
That's
very, very, very salty miso soup on top of salmon.
Uh-huh.
I remember...
That doesn't sound right.
No, they didn't have a telephone, so I can't complain to my mother
uh-huh.
that way, but...
So she stayed in Osaka, but
she stayed in Osaka, and then she escaped. In Osaka, there are lots of the air raid exercises.
Mm-hmm.
We had this, and when it was once a week or so, maybe sometimes twice a week, we have to go down to the bomb shelters.
Mm-hmm.
Bomb shelters are actually made in about every third with the, fourth houses that we have is communal. The bomb shelters, so they just go down there. I really didn't like it because I have a phobia about spiders.
Uh-huh.
Anytime I go down there, I can see the huge spiders there. So, but then I have to go down because there's always a huge cases of the people dying with the area. They used to have incendio bombs,
mm-hmm.
but the fin, when they explode, the fin comes off. And I remember in one instance that one of my friends said, "Hey, let's go. There's a guy who's standing, but their head is gone. So let's go see it." So I went to see it. There was a man, dead man standing,
mm-hmm.
but head is blown off because mm-hmm. the shrapnel actually chopped his head off completely.
Mm-hmm.
And that type of experience in Osaka. So after my house is born, we decided to go back to Hiroshima.
Right.
Originally, we didn't really have much of the ideas what to do, but in Hiroshima, it's another family's members were there
uh-huh.
Having confectionery stores
uh-huh.
near Koi, train station, like a tram station.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided, after everything burns, there's nothing for me to carry around. you know, I wanted to take that the wooden elephant toys, which is my favorite toys.
Mm.
But my parents said, you don't have any space for that, so unfortunately I did not take that.
Mm. That is too bad.
Yeah, I still remember that. I have pictures of this, and then somehow the picture survived. So my kids are looking at, oh, that's an elephant there. It's just
So, I mean, you seem to have family connections to both Yamaguchi and
so
Hiroshima.
So, I think we arrived in Hiroshima maybe early July or something like that. I don't really recall much. But we were on the kind of rear end of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And that confectionery store was a little bit more modern, Western style. So they even have a Western style, the toilet there too.
Mm-hmm.
But then we were eating the breakfast on August 8th,
mm-hmm.
at August 6th. And then we heard a huge noise outside, and we thought there's some big bomb drop, because a few days before the atomic bomb, they had the U.S. Air Force put the two types of leaflet.
Mm-hmm.
So they are actually recommending the citizens to escape, go out of the town if you want to survive, because we're going to drop a new type of bomb and you can't really survive. And the other one was Tojo was putting the house down, and other cartoons there.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember two distinct for the leaflets there.
You remember seeing them?
Right, yeah, I used to pick up those things.
Mm.
And then shortly after that, the police came and confiscated all those things. I should have kept it, but you know. Anyhow, because of that, I thought, well, maybe this must be the big. New type of bomb.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I looked at toward the city, it's all black and mm-hmm. smoke is there, and there's really lots of noise, but there's probably no reason for us to go backward.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, a friend of mine, like Mr. Mori, was living, I didn't know at that time, but to hear about him, but his house was maybe 1 kilometer away from my house, the house I used to remember. And his parents were in Hiroshima City, so he went back there. So, but for us, we only had a couple packages, Furoshiki Tsutsumi. So we decided to say, I told our relatives, say, hey, I think I'll go back to my, grandmother's place in Ikeda-cho, Takatagun,
mm-hmm.
almost close to the Shimaneken. And that took a long time, because when I have never walked that path, because in the past we used to take a bus down to downtown, or whenever during the daytime, during the summertime, we used to visit my grandmother's from Hiroshima Station to the other route to Takatagun. But this time, I had to walk with my parents, and I started walking and walking, and it was a very hot day. And then about 15-30 minutes ago, I think they had a big squall of rain.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, we were near the temple, so
mm-hmm.
we were inside the temple for perhaps about 2 hours. So
mm-hmm.
the rain stopped. And then we started walking. Then by evening, we arrived to grandmother's farm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we escaped. My experience to Hiroshima is, in a sense, it's the hibakusha, because we breathed and we have the exposed to all sorts of ashes. But then physically, we're not really
mm-hmm.
damaged.
How close were you to hypocenter?
Koi must be 5, maybe 6 kilometers from the hypocenter.
Mm-hmm.
You showed it on the the model they used to have in the museum. I don't know if it's still there.
Oh,
but you
yeah.
said it was around the 5 kilometers.
I don't know whether they have that in this Mr. Morris. Oh, good. Now, anyhow, let's.
And do you have a certificate of survival food?
Maybe I'm registered. Many of my friends are not registered as the Hibakusha Techo, mm-hmm. and there's a reason for that. I think many of my friends, after I came back to the Hiroshima city,
mm-hmm.
and started the elementary school for 6 years, and then at Chugakko and Kozugakko, and many friends during the middle schools and high schools are survivors too. And then also there are many who came back from other cities.
Mm-hmm.
And we never talked about Hibakusha Techo,
mm-hmm.
and registered as a Hibakusha.
Mm-hmm.
There was some stigma attached to that.
Mm-hmm.
That's why when we were kid, we never talked about who is Hibakusha and who is not.
Do you remember anybody, such as your parents, your school teachers, or maybe neighbors, talking about the bomb after the war was over?
No, they usually do not. Well, that's such a big thing, so that we talk about on that context, when the day-by-day things we see is always associated with that. Buildings are broken and burnt, and we have to repair those buildings. And the evening when you go to middle schools, we found lots of the skeleton, human skeletons on the corner.
Mm-hmm.
There must be the group of people who were waiting for going into the Otagawa, try to drink water,
mm-hmm.
and then they died there.
Mm-hmm.
So that the school teachers actually guided us to there to pick up all the bones and have the memorial service done by the Buddhist priest.
Mm-hmm.
But interesting, because among our friends, we never talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we knew what that about.
Mm-hmm.
And science teacher tells me about uranium, the 235 and things like that. So we know that was the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly after that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But
do you think it was even before the U.S. military force lifted the regulation about the information about the bomb? Because during the occupation period, it was not mostly allowed for people to talk about it.
You see, the thing is, the probably you don't read about it. You remember General MacArthur had the media control, 100% media control, and then he ordered media not to mention about anything about or impact about,
mm-hmm.
and for that reason that the actual awareness of the actual impact of the atomic bomb,
mm-hmm.
is not publicized,
mm-hmm.
and I think that probably one of the reasons why we didn't talk about it, not because somebody told us not to,
mm-hmm.
but it's not been on the newspaper until, much recent, much later than now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because there's early on and with junior high, that making a Geiger counter is very easy. Making a 2 aluminum foils and things like that. And so we had in our science class, we made a handmade Geiger counters.
Mm-hmm.
And then try to see, is there any hot spot in the school?
Mm-hmm.
Because our school is very close to the epicenter. It's not really,
mm-hmm.
It's probably about 3 kilometers away.
Mm.
And but we found radioactivity on that the insulator for the electric wires.
Mm-hmm.
They used to have the molten sulfur was the one that they used as an insulator.
Mm-hmm.
So that they have a glass insulator and put the molten sulfur and put the screws on top. And that particular was piece, we found very high the radiation there.
Mm.
So, you know, the teacher, science teacher, tried to take an advantage of the radioactivities.
I see, as an educational material, so
yes.
to speak.
Yeah.
What do you think that you were thinking about yourself potentially being victimized by it, or at least affected by it, but also seeing that in the classroom environment?
It's interesting because it was not victimized in the sense that the other people, because I didn't have any external injuries, and I didn't really have a horrible experience with people being killed in front of me. But on the way to my grandmother's place, I saw lots of people dying on the street. Some of them had a very serious injuries, and some of them had seriously burnt. People who are outside is burnt, even though 6-7 kilometers away. And so for that reason, I think psychologically, I think I felt like I've been victimized. But when you were 8 years old, it doesn't really sink in the same way, because my parents are more affected than myself.
And you yourself, remind me again, didn't really have a particular memory of the moment of the explosion.
No, we had a big sound, you know, big noise.
But do you remember reacting to it?
I didn't think we really reacted to that because we were eating breakfast. The breakfast was more important for escaping.
Okay, yes.
Is it, my mother said, well, let's see, go out and see.
Mm.
She once said, the city is burning. So, okay, that's what the reason why I didn't really react immediately. But
I see.
Since there's no reason to go back to the town, then we were at that point that we were thinking of going back to my grandmother's farm. So it looked like that there's really no way in there to react to that. And besides, we don't want it to burden my relatives anymore. We have been there for at least a week before something like this. So then we just said, you know, we'll go back to the grandmother's farm.
How about your family member? I remember in a brief two-page summary of your memory of the bomb that you supplied me earlier,
yes,
there are some family members who were injured and
affected. Yes, as I mentioned, my grandmother's, he had three wives. Well, my father was from the first marriage. And then second one is he married the first woman graduate of the University of Hiroshima. And the third one is a barmaid somehow. But anyhow, the second grandmother, all three women lived in the same city. They knew each other. And my grandfather, he must be the kind of the ladies man, but for that reason we had this kind of complex relatives living in there. One of the relatives was Uncle Masaru, and the other one was the uncle Yoshinori, and the Yoshinori and I forgot the second one, but Chieko is the girl from the second marriage of my grandmother, her grandfather, and she was a nurse, the licensed nurse, and she used to work in the Teishin Byouin, the communication hospitals, in Hakushima. Hakushima is actually the north of the epicenter, and so we knew that she was working there, and she decided to go back to the work that day, and although it was Sunday, but she wasn't really physically hurt from her house, And so she stayed there for, I don't know how many weeks, but she worked in a hospital helping, but it came to a point that she started feeling weak, and so occasionally she started vomit the blood, and they started having a nose bleeding. So she actually came, by that time, actually that was mid-September 1945. Some kind of transportations there, I think, because she came to see us at the grandmother's farm. And then my mother knew that she was really bad shape. She was kind of heavy set. We used to call her Buttachan. But she's no longer Buttachan anymore. Mm-hmm. She's physically emaciated, really skin and bone. And her gums are purple. Mm-hmm. And she used to have a more frequent nose bleeding and things like that. So we took care of her, and then I think she died in mid-October. It was a severe radiation sickness.
Right.
By that time, the word radiation sickness was actually called atomic bomb sickness.
Right.
Came back Bill.
Right.
And so we lost the aunt that way.
Right. So I'm wondering if there is any family conversations about that,
you know,
or anybody that they must have seen. I'm interested in this question because I see that many survivors
don't
have a chance to talk about it.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting though, because my mother was furious about the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
My father was, but my father was in hiding, so they not really allowed to say anything. He was really on low profile because of the my father's company was. You know, my first company was the military companies.
Mm-hmm.
And so after that, there was very active purging. Anybody who were associated with former military industries would be either incarcerated or something. So he did not even mention his names. He was actually in hiding for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So my father's opinion about the atomic bomb was not, you know, not really that severe. He was always kind of neutral things.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother was really furious about.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that she was worried about you, about herself, about her family members?
Yeah, we were constantly worried about it because I think that probably that worry is true too, because my mother died from the leukemia, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, which is at that age, she died at the age of 82.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not that common leukemia, because usually you see those leukemia in younger people.
Mm-hmm.
And could be, and there's no way to prove that was due to
that.
But the funniest thing is, I came down with cancer, thyroid cancer.
Mm-hmm.
It was 2000. That was at the 2007.
Mm-hmm.
By funny reason that my endocrinologist actually, who was the treating my diabetes,
mm-hmm.
for the he was looking as well, listening to my throat,
mm-hmm.
and he asked me, "Do you have the asthma?" I says, "No,
mm-hmm.
I can breathe well. Do you have?" Tuberculosis? No, I worked with the several similar bacteria when I was an undergraduate,
mm-hmm.
and I'm highly positive for the tuberculosis skin test.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no symptoms or nothing. And let's take pictures on it. So we take x-rays.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing, the line was clear and everything clear except there was kind of funny shadows.
Mm.
On that part of the X-ray
mm-hmm.
that was developed. And he said, "What is that black shadow?" Says,
mm.
"Well, what happened was they looked at with the ultrasound
mm-hmm.
and they found the huge thyroid globules, tumors there. And then, so let's take it out and look and see what that is. So he took out, the surgeon took out only part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to identify what was the type of cancer. Nobody could identify in Sparrow's pathology department.
Mm.
And people keep saying, oh, that's bizarre.
Mm.
So they among them, the doctors, they start talking bizarroma. And the good thing was this endocrinologist attended the meeting a couple months earlier of the thyroid cancer by the Chernobyl's exposure.
Uh-huh.
And Dr. Libosi, Virginia Libosi, is professor of pathology at the Pittsburgh University.
Mm-hmm.
And so he contacted her, and then Sparrow sent the sample to Dr. Libosi. And she immediately sent back the email. This is a follicular carcinoma of the thyroid,
mm-hmm.
which is very popular among the Chernobyl the people. And then this is usually caused by the extreme exposure to the radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So I must have had this thyroid cancer for many years, but encapsulated for many years.
I see.
And then it became so big that pressed my trachea.
Mm.
So that's why the whistling sound is heard.
Right.
And that was the reason why he... Now you open the Pandora's box, you have to take everything out. So the surgeon actually went back into the same place and then took all the thyroid organs.
Mm-hmm.
He was so good, I don't even have any scar tissue at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then since then I had to take the synthetic thyroid hormone. But
mm-hmm.
that's the worry about cancer. Yes, we had the worry about cancer.
Did you tell your doctor that you're a survivor?
Yeah, some of them don't ask to do when they don't ask questions. I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't really give any information that helps my, taking care of my health.
Mm-hmm. I ask you this because some people I talked to had told me that it was difficult to tell their doctors here in the States because some doctors might feel uncomfortable about a piece of information
yeah.
because they don't probably know what to do with it.
There's nothing you can do about it, number one. There's no place to report to either. And the good thing is this doctor is a Jordanian, so he was trained in Jordan, and so that's one of the things. We became good friends, but when he sees me, he said, "Wow, that's the big difference in because people in this area, the American pathologists cannot tell the cell type by looking at stained cells, whether that the cancer is the Chernobyl type or not."
Mm-hmm.
And so they can just take the bizarre cancers.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of the reasons why, there's clearly no reason to give them that information. They can't do much
mm-hmm.
to help me.
Mm-hmm. So let me switch a gear a little bit. I like to come back to what happened after you were affected by the bomb later on in our conversation, but now I like to ask you somewhat different sets of questions. So earlier you told me that you have connection, family connection to both Yamaguchi
mm-hmm.
Prefecture and Hiroshima Prefecture.
Right.
And as you know, both of those prefectures are known to be the big sources of immigrants to America and
That's
to
right.
Hawaii. So you can probably tell me a little bit about your family connection to people
okay.
who have gone
My
to those
relatives
places.
Are kind of well, Yamaguchi is not really that thick areas. We went to my uncle's house. It was second uncle was at the tent makers, earnings and tent. And Gold and I went there.
The countryside.
Mm.
It's beautiful
yeah.
the train when you go on the train. It's
oh, yeah.
It reminds me of when you take the Amtrak to Chicago.
Oh.
It's a beautiful countryside.
Mm-hmm. In Yamaguchi Prefecture.
Yeah.
Yamaguchi Prefecture.
So
yeah.
Uh-huh. I visited 1986. We visited my uncle there. And so the second grandmother He had three kids. And my father was somehow adopted by the second woman, second grandmother. And
meaning the second wife of your father's side grandfather?
Yeah.
Am I right?
Okay. Right. My mother's side, I can tell you. I don't know who that grandfather is. According to my grandmother, my mother's mother, he said he's a gigolo, so that was kind of, that we never follow up on that one.
Mm-hmm.
But, she had three kids. Chieko, who died
mm-hmm.
From that atomic bomb, and then the two, Yoshinori, and then I forgot the name, the second one is a tent maker.
Uh-huh.
And so that's where we actually visited Yamaguchi. And originally, my father's, the great grandfather had this the brewery in Yamaguchi Prefecture, the Wadagun. So that part, but the other, my father's side, my first grandmother, my real grandmother, my father's side, went back and then remarried. I think Fujimoto's family.
Mm-hmm.
So the and then had a son and a couple daughters. But one son was Masaru, Fujimoto Masaru was since they have relatives in the United States, early on he came to United States and then he studied in UCLA as a journalism.
Mm-hmm.
I still remember having his graduation pictures in our house.
Uh-huh.
But
what year was it, do you remember?
It must be about 1940 or maybe 39, somewhere around there.
And that's the graduation year for him at UCLA.
Right.
Mm. Do you know when he went to the States?
I don't know when he went, but he finished, so he must have gone there quite a long time because he has no accent at all, because his English is really perfect English.
Mm-hmm.
I used to admire him. Yeah, how can he speak in both Japanese and English and simultaneously? And my uncle used to say, left side of my mouth in English, right side of my mouth in Japanese. Oh, yeah, that's pretty good. Anyhow, I used to have a very good time with him. Well, before that, U.S. still had the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo. And Aunt Sakiko and Uncle Masaru must have married around 1940. Well, before that, maybe 39 or so. They came back shortly after he graduated from UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
They had this the exchange board, the repatriation board.
Mm-hmm.
Other family members actually remained and they went to concentration camp,
mm-hmm.
Internment camp.
Right.
But this particular group of my uncle and then Aunt Sakiko, it was Aunt Sakiko came from Harada, who they stayed in internment camp.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went back to Tokyo, but they didn't have much of anything. So my father helped them quite a bit, found the apartment near the U.S. embassies, so that in Roppongi areas they had this very modern, westernized type of. My aunt Sakiko, her name is Japanese, but she has no background as a Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
Her Japanese was pretty broken Japanese anyhow. But
was she born in the States or born in Hawaii?
She was born in Hawaii.
Yes, right.
And then went back to mainland.
Uh-huh.
And what happened was that during the war, just before the war, they used to come to my house. My uncle usually they go to see other people in Hiroshima. So on the way, he just dropped in the Osaka, and then he spent a day or so with us.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the German usually come around that time. So then day after, so we used to have, the special police used to come in.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, they used to search our house inside out,
mm-hmm.
but they found nothing to really, so they tried to get more information. I became a good friend of the one of the detectives because they tried to get the information.
Right.
So
right.
The only information they got from me is where the candies came from.
Right. And, you're a child.
Right. So that kind of an interesting situation.
Uh-huh.
And for that reason, my father was really scared after the war.
I see.
And you remember after the war that all the savings would be nullified.
Right.
So we started from zero.
Right.
And the nice thing is my father had kind of techniques that as a metal worker. And when he was teenage, he helped the paving that atomic dome.
It
used to be a Chamber of Commerce building.
Right.
And so he kept telling me, you know, I used to climb up onto the domes and used to pave all the copper sheets. Mm-hmm. So I remember that. But that's for that reason my father used to repair the pots and pans for the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And then we used to, my uncle, my mother's brother, and my father, is a good, the good terms, so they used to go down to the city. We were there for about 6 months, but even that, we survived by, you know, buying the generators from the black market and installed that for the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
So money-wise, by working here and there. So.
Mm-hmm. Going back to your uncle and this Hawaii-born aunt, were they affected by the bomb as well, or did they
stay
outside of
Hiroshima? They were in Tokyo in that time. And
they
found us, they were so worried, because that the Fujimoto also owned that the confectionery that I stayed on the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went back to that house, and Uncle Masaru had two sisters, and they went back.
Mm-hmm.
So after the war, two sisters lived there for a while, and then they sold the building and they lived around that areas.
Oh, so they didn't come back to here, to the States or to Hawaii?
No, my Uncle Masaru never came back. I don't know why.
Uh-huh.
But since he spoke both languages pretty fluently.
Uh-huh.
So he was hired as the editor-in-chief of the English daily Mainichi.
Mm-hmm.
And so that he was pretty happy until he retired from that.
Mm.
And that's why we went to see Uncle Masaru, too.
It's interesting because he always had a word book. I remember this one thing when we went to visit him, is he had this notebook and he kept the words.
Mm.
So some new word,
I see.
Go into this word book.
To keep his translating ability sharp.
Even in the hospital, he had this. Remember the book? I carry a notebook.
He has always a word of a day.
I
think the Mainichi, they have a small column the every day, the word of a day. So he had to find some, almost impossible words that the people will find, or there may be something that people might like to use, English words.
Mm-hmm.
So he used to write some small columns there. But he used to come, that was the way after that, when I went to the college, I used to take care of my cousin, in that kind of distant cousin, but for their, my cousin at that time was junior high and senior high.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to take care of their homeworks. And my uncle, my uncle was so busy, so usually come home about 2 o'clock in the morning, and he goes to work about 10 o'clock in the morning too. And the aunt Sakiko was pretty much, she said, I don't know all this math, so you teach him. So I used to teach the mathematics and all the homeworks duties. And in return, my uncle gave me pretty good allowance. So I was in the college, I didn't have to worry too much about the spending money.
So I am trying to figure out what people like you, or people to be more specific, who had a family connections to America, might have had as an image of America as a country when you're growing up before the war, and maybe some of it might have been changed because of the war, it might not have. So I like to kind of know.
Interesting thing, I never heard of the internment camp until I saw Uncle Harada, my the aunt Sakiko's father. We were reading about it occasionally, but among the Japanese after the war, we never heard, you know, things like how much is 125,000 Japanese Americans incarcerated, and various about seven, you know, the internment camps in the United States, and no, we didn't really talk about it until I met him. So the things we know about the United States when I was a kid was occasionally Aunt Sakiko's relative sent some care pack from the United States, and she shared with us. And so I learned about the United States that way. And so that's one of the reasons why I think it's a very kind of remote things.
That in my was family, before you came to the States that you
before
learned
I came
about
to the United States. But you know, I met my uncle, Minoru Harada, when I came to the United States in the 1960s, and 61 or 2, he invited me to New York. He had an office in New York. They lived in New Jersey, but he had a branch office of Odakiri Mercantile. Odakiri is, you know, the export-import companies. You can still see those emblems on any of those now. But he told me also all the story about the Americans that the, you know, incarcerated, about many Japanese Americans, and what, and they had a very hard time in a camp. And Mr. Odakiri and he became very good friends. And
I
that's
see.
Why he became.
I
and
see.
There was, they somehow related to the group in Chicago too, but that's how I learned about it. But again, he doesn't talk much about what happened in internment camp either. So I said, what happened? Well, it's a very hard life. But you know what? We survived. And he became a very good Presbyterian, you know, the Christian. He said the forgiveness is very important. So he doesn't talk about what detail, what happened to that.
So remind me, so this uncle who was interned during World War II was your relative from...
The relative was... So what happened is the uncle Masaru's wife, Aunt Sakiko's father, is that the Mr. Harada.
Okay.
And that's the way that we are related to.
Okay, yeah.
So.
Okay. So this uncle is through Uncle Aunt Sakiko's family.
Yep.
That you are connected to. Okay.
So, however, though, from him, we don't really hear much about how he suffered in the internment camp.
Right.
I always try to find out. There must be some commonalities there. And so that's what...
Let me ask you this. So,
okay.
So this sort of, you know, what happened after World War II is very interesting. But I guess I'm also interested in how you might have had as an image of America when you were little, before you came here or before the war.
When I was little, I wanted to become a Navy man. So the definitely the image of the United States is not really good. You know, the brainwashed by the cartoons. Whenever you go to a movie theater, and the first 5 minutes to 10 minutes of the cartoons, that actually the cartoon actually is the propaganda type of thing. And also they have news, because that we don't really have a way to hear the news except the radio and the movies. Whenever I go to movie theaters, and you will see how the Japanese Empire is expanding. And the United States is really losing the Guadalcanals and the Midway warfares. We are getting another victorious date. Well, I tell you what, those movies were not really true. I read about the history of the World War II. Guadalcanal and Midway, Japan lost miserably. At that time, they didn't even have a warship.
Mm.
And I thought it's kind of interesting. However, though, when I was a kid, I didn't really have much of the ideas about it.
How about through America, through your aunt and uncle? Because they were there.
You know, it's interesting. They usually don't talk much about how the America is, because they only know West Coast, mm-hmm. right? So they have they have a nice cars and a house and things like that. But Uncle Masaru did not talk much about the American way of life.
Mm. Interesting.
Although when I went to college, he started saying about, you know, as a matter of fact, I think we shouldn't have started the war, something like that.
Mm.
And the day I went to the interview at the St. Paul's University, they have those the entrance exam and an interview.
Mm-hmm.
That was St. Patrick's Day.
Uh-huh.
And he said, on a train, he asked me, do you know what day it is today? He said, yeah, I don't know. It's March 30th, March 17th. Said, yeah. And he said, it's St. Patrick's Day. You know who the St. Patrick's is? Guardian Saints of Ireland and them. And all these things. So make sure you mm-hmm. say about St. Patrick's. Well, lo and behold, I was interviewed by a couple of experienced priests.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know what day is it today? I said, oh, yes. Hallelujah. So I said, yes, St. Patrick's Day. Yeah, no problem there.
Very good.
I thought it's kind of interesting.
Mm. Do you think that being affected by the bomb, but also you saw people who were affected by it in a more severe way, an obvious way than you?
Psychologically, yeah, I think I have.
What do you think that it might have done to your image of America as a country? If you can
I thought Americans,
say anything about it.
You know, the more I learn about marvelous theories of atomic bombs, and I started wondering, why do they have to do this?
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing I said. And if these people believe in Christian religion, why do they have to do that? That's one of the interesting things about it. And I found some of the interesting clue when I the later on, I read a book called Sun Across the Bridge by Gwen Terasaki.
Mm-hmm.
That book is a very interesting book. But Gwen Terasaki and my uncle Masaru actually had on a different part of the world. They were in the United States
mm-hmm.
As the Japanese. And Mr. Terasaki is American and yet married a Japanese ambassador. And she had a really hard time. She went back to Japan.
Mm.
And they had a really hard time in Japan. People thought that the American woman marrying a Japanese ambassador should not be really having a good time at all. So, however, though, in her book saying that on the day of the Pearl Harbor, they describe it quite differently. And Mr. Terasaki warned Americans 2 weeks ahead of time that the fleet of the warship is coming. And also the day when, that was the day before, so the day before the Pearl Harbor Day, it was Sunday, he went to the White House and asked to speak to President Roosevelt.
Mm.
He was actually told to get away. Who did was the chaplain, Mr. Webster, the chaplain in the White House at that time.
Mm.
And she wrote this very much in detail, how the Ambassador Terasaki was actually chased away from the White House.
Mm.
And so I started saying, wait a minute, this is a chaplain who's supposed to keep peace, mm-hmm. and yet it was probably somehow promoted that ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, gee, maybe my idea about the United States when I was a child may be correct.
Mm.
You know, as a warmongers, and again, we'd never thought about Japan being warmongers, trying to control entire Asia, but
mm-hmm.
That was about my American idea. So.
Mm. So tell me a little bit about how you went back to school, but in the one in Hiroshima after the war was over.
Yes.
And you were saying that even though there are things that people did, like your science class teacher, about the bomb, but there was not much talk, per se, between friends.
You know, when you were 10 to 12, maybe 14 years old, we didn't understand the meaning of the bomb to the entire society's entire human race.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, whenever my classmate dies, you know, the classmate keep dying on class, so that sometimes we have to combine classes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So the, you know, when one third of the classmates is gone, you start worrying about, hey, gee, maybe I'll be the next one.
Yes.
Right? And when you start having a nose bleeding, and you start worrying about it.
Right.
And I used to have a good friend who used to play judo, and I used to lose quite a bit, 100% of the time. And one day I started winning, and then I wondered, why is it that he started having purple spots in the mouth, and, so that's why bleeding spots. So these are the experience, but that people feel about it, we never talk about it, because talking probably aggravates a lot. And we make all sorts of joke about things, and we're too busy playing. So
yeah, well, yes.
So the, you know, that we used to pull the allowance and go to the black market and get the material to make radio. They used to have a Navy has a very nice textbook, electronic textbook, and we studied the Navy textbook on electronics. And so that's how I started building radios and transmitters and things like that. Parts are very easy to get because American used to sell Air Force have to change the vacuum tubes almost every 90 hours or so by regulation. So these things goes into the black market.
I
so
see.
If you pull those my allowance and with a couple other guys, it was easy to make the radios.
So that was during the occupational period.
Well, during the occupation, yes.
Right.
And we really hated it, but you know, it's very easy to get those parts. But even though I was a kid, but we never talked about my father's background, so my uncle used to come. I try to keep them a secret.
Yeah. So maybe you can tell me a little bit about how. Did you get married before you came to the States in 1960, or did you get married afterward? I'd like to know what brought you here.
I came to the United States in the 1960s because I was actually, when I entered the St. Paul's University, Rikkyo, I was a linguistics major in the first 2 years. Then I had a girlfriend, and so maybe if I was serious about this girlfriend, I don't think I can really support this woman just being an English teacher. So I thought.
But you're thinking about becoming an English teacher then?
Yeah, but the linguistics was it. But then maybe I should do something serious about it. So I changed my major into chemistry. Well, that was a big mistake. They changed my major into chemistry. On the second day, I got, you see the whole equation, partial differential equations and the integral, double, triple integral equations. And I miserably failed thermodynamics in the first the round. I took about the exam for 7 times and I finally got B. That was very good. as a matter of fact, the thermodynamics is my favorite the subject now. Even. But while doing that, I didn't even date anything, so the girlfriend went away. I have nothing else to do. So what the heck is it? So by that time, my professor, actually biochemistry professor, was working with American universities.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, why don't you go to Wayne State? There's a Professor Chen, who is very well known in the lipid metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay, fine. But you don't really have the owner points enough to get the Fulbright. But I think you can probably get some grant monies.
Mm-hmm.
So you can only take $200 in your pocket.
Mm.
$200 in those days was a really big issue.
Yes.
The 1 yen was 360, you know, it says 360 yen per dollar.
Mm-hmm.
So I came here with $200 in my pocket. And I thought, when I landed in Seattle, August 27, 1960,
mm-hmm.
gee, wait a minute, if I don't succeed, I'm going to die on the street somewhere. And I thought, but I wasn't so worried because our family started from zero many times, so
mm-hmm.
I can start something. But then my English is not really good, so it was a big issue. But then that's why I
mm-hmm.
went to the Wayne State.
Mm-hmm.
And
was there anybody in your family who opposed to your coming to the States?
We did. But anyhow, my mother said, you never come back. Well, sure, I come back. He said, keep that. I promise you. I said to my mother, but you know, no. Actually, it came true because I never went back.
Yes.
So when I was there, I was in graduate school. And in my same class, my wife was in the same class.
Oh.
And if you look around the graduate school, 1960s, most of the graduate school students have wives and kids. You try to find the single woman, it's almost impossible.
Mm.
Anyhow, but then we've been studying together, and then fell in love and tried to marry. 1964, we
mm-hmm.
married a Polish American woman.
Mm-hmm.
That's why Gordon doesn't look like Japanese.
They are from and your wife.
Yes.
What's her name?
Her name is Geraldine.
Geraldine,
yeah,
Zybek.
They have a particular Polish name. And
it's funny because I ended up marrying a Polish wife too.
He married a Polish wife.
Back
again.
Uh-huh.
So if he had the kid, he'd become back again to Polish blood. Okay,
Polish.
Anyhow, that was a kind of interesting time. 1964, or the year after the state of Michigan. Approved of the interracial marriage.
Uh-huh.
And when we married, about 17 states were still, in 17 states they were illegal
mm-hmm.
to have an interracial marriage.
Right, right.
And we didn't know that. And we went to Chicago on the honeymoon.
Uh-huh.
Well, the state of Illinois wasn't. And we had a really hard time to try to get the hotel rooms.
Mm.
And that's one of the things that we experienced.
Mm.
But my wife, actually, I have seen lots of those covert discriminations.
Mm.
But
how about finding a house to buy? Many people talk about
it's interesting because we were in an apartment in Boston. Shortly after I got my degree, I had to go back to Japan for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we were in Nagoya and lived as a gaijin, but Nagoya, the cancer research center.
Mm-hmm.
And then we came back to Boston, in the apartment. I didn't really have much of problems.
I see.
In academia. And then there I had this very particular techniques to make peptide,
mm-hmm.
solid phase peptide. Most of the pharmaceutical companies did not have that in
mm-hmm.
those days. So having that technology, Upjohn in Kalamazoo was very eager to hire me. So
mm-hmm.
I came to Upjohn in 1972. That was the time when my daughter was born. And he was born in Boston. And
so when you get married, did you think about you being a survivor and possibly having an effect on either the marriage itself or maybe if you decide to
have children? But
you know,
we can't do much about it. So, I told my wife and saying, when you think about it, you know, the kid may have some defective genes, but you have a good genes, so probably you can repair the any defect that I have. But it was laughing about it, but we didn't really think about the effect of you know, the kind of a nuclear bombs, atomic bomb on the next generation. Indeed, in Hiroshima, that was a big issue of being, you know, segregated, so discriminated against, so that the most of people don't even talk about who is, who got production, who isn't. Among our kids, the friends, high school kids, unless somebody tells me, we never talked about it, we never asked them. You know, it's not, it's, we somehow knew that we should never ask that question to our friends. And so we never talked about it.
I see.
The same way, my wife knew that I'm from Hiroshima, and I'm from the under the atomic bomb, but I think we never make a big issue out of it. Maybe I shouldn't have had this kid.
Jeez.
Yeah, but people vary about this. It's not as though just because somebody is a survivor, they always have the same answer when it comes to things like marriage and, you know, childbearing. So that's
well,
the reason why I asked.
Well, from the beginning, I said about my background, so, you know, that was not a big issue on that. Oh, for my wife.
Going back a little bit in time, what was your impression when you first came to the States?
You know, I was overwhelmed because of the second day I attended this school, that I thought, I understand everything and people, professor write on the blackboard, equations and chemical formulas. And then problem I had was that I can't read fast enough, I can't write fast enough. And for that reason, my grades started dropping like nobody's business. But then I started the writing and reading quite differently. I skipped the lines and tried to get organized first. And then another thing I did was I usually write in diagrams so that everything is in diagrams. So even now, when I give a lecture to the engineering, chemical engineering students, I just put all this, the metabolic chart in diagrams. And my students said, how do you remember all these metabolic? It's almost like a word. So
the but most it's faster to write down.
It's for me faster than, so the yes and no and the arrows and the chemical reaction, the write another reaction, this happens. And that actually made the professors much easier for me to grade it. So
I see.
By the time I graduated, my wife and I got probably the top class. And she writes everything in the blue books, 10 of them. I write in blue books. And we got about same points. And the difference is that mine is all pictures. And hers are all sentences. And that's the...
And by then you were both graduate students, am I right?
Or yes.
And that's how you first came to the States, to
yes,
Wayne State?
Yes, because I went to Rikkyo University.
Right, and you graduated and
then... Oh, by the way, Rikkyo had a very interesting history. I think it's 1953, Episcopal Church of the United States gave them first research-grade nuclear reactors. And for that reason, I had all the techniques of the nuclear chemistry.
I see.
I know how to count the radiations and how to purify the radioactive element and how to make a compound that contains the radioactive compound. And so by the time I went to Wayne, American did not have that technique. So I was one of the rare students who had technologies there. So I synthesized the cholesterol molecule that had the carbon 14 in one areas, and then the tritium on the other end, and that kind of things. I was able to do that. So
yeah. That's interesting. Now, you mentioned to me earlier that there was some racial tension to be discriminated against in terms of, you know, where to stay tonight when you were in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Must have left some impression on you. And I think it's true that that's one of those things that shape difference between Japan and America. Japan is a very homogeneous society, whereas America is very diverse. How do you think about the relationship between men and women, especially with regard to what society expects men to behave like men, women to behave like women? I think that's another aspect that those society may be both similar to and different from each other.
That's true too, because, you know, I very often give both American students and Japanese students lectures. And when I give lectures to the Japanese student, I introduce American society as much as I can from my impression.
Mm-hmm.
And then the issue like LGBT issues occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And the in Japan, still the LGBT is a big taboo. People never talk about it. They probably will be highly discriminated.
Mm-hmm.
They think they're only the, you know, artists and some eccentric people are. But what I usually tell them, that the thing is, people are people, whatever the sexual orientations and their belief, for instance, whether Catholic or Buddhist,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't really matter, because we really have to live in this world together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you can't really have the attitude saying that I'm holier than thou attitude.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That probably is the worst thing to do. So the my lecture, that I have at least 4 or 5 slides on the statistics about the general LGBT, the ratio of 3.5% in
mm-hmm.
particular population groups.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the transgenic peoples.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have a transgenic. The trend is actually hormonal things. And you should not really look at as because they have a different orientation because of their own likings. Probably they can't help. The people cannot help.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that, we don't know. I think it has something to do with birth control pills. Probably the eggs are soaked in the high concentration of progesterone. And that, but nobody would like to study that. The pharmaceutical company is getting billions of dollars of money from the birth control pills. If somebody says, maybe that's the reason why you have a different sexual orientation of the entire society, you get killed.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the fish, because of that, the many bays, the Chesapeake bays, fish usually have 1/3 of the fish population change the sex during the development
mm-hmm.
and become male fish, and to get the more propagated themselves. They can't do that anymore. So that certain blend of the fish, the certain strain is dying away.
Mm-hmm.
So the farmer does, the aquaculture people does, is they put the testosterone on the areas
mm-hmm.
to recover the sexual ratio between.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just mentioned that to the students. Wow, now fish is all females, that was? So that's, I say, yeah, that's true. But these things is very interesting because of that, in many streams, they have very high concentration of testosterone, estrogens,
mm-hmm.
and that is causing the environmental effect.
Because right.
So the
endocrine... Plastic, too.
Huh?
Plastics,
yeah,
estrogenic mimics.
Yeah, the
plastics.
Well, plastics. The
insecticide and plastic.
A couple million tons of that plastics, and also herbicide. And the one of the herbicide is about 50 times more potent than estrogen itself.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, amount of the estrogen in the river and the streams, because of the oral contraceptives, is probably not much of the effect, because you have millions of times more coming from the farming ground.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is the type of thing that I usually give my students.
Do you think that you were thinking about those issues when you were first beginning to get to know American society, or is this something that you thought about later on, more recently?
No, this is pretty much the recent things.
What about your first few years, maybe first
years,
5-6 years of being here? Did you notice any difference in terms of gender using?
The gender is actually, no, it's, wait, I tell you what, they used to make fun out of those homosexuals. Remember? In Detroit, there was, in a Greek town, there was a couple of bars that the usually homosexual goes. And then the bar owners have this, the one-way mirror, and then you can go the other way. And so in the graduate school say, hey, let's go drink and see how these homosexuals are behaving.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know, that's kind of the discrimination or some kind of a, well, I don't think it was funny, but the people thought it was funny among the graduate student. And when we go drink, I never told my girlfriend that we go there to drink things, but.
What about relationship between men and women? I think in Japanese society, there are certain kind of gender expectation that affects relationship between men and women, especially, let's say, take an example of a wife and a
Yeah, wife has to do a certain wifely duty. Well, I tell you that, for survival, I don't think you can really demand my wife, you know, to stay home and do what she did, actually. But we actually share most of the household chores together.
Mm-hmm.
And then we decide, decision-making wise, we decide together so that we don't really have who is going to make the final say about yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
So usually we have pretty much the kind of equal right to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think, I didn't really have much of an expectation or otherwise. The kind of interesting things happened when we married. Church, a very racially oriented church. So her church, the Catholic church, guardian angel, the church of guardian angel in Detroit, refused to marry us.
Mm.
And so I kind of turned to my campus chaplain, and they said, how about on the campus we have the Our Lady of Holy Rosaries on Woodward and Expressway. So they wanted to talk to him.
Mm.
And there was a Father Safai who came from Malta, Maltese. He says, what? You want to marry that? I don't think we can do it. Anyhow, I talked to my brother-in-law to me about this. Oh, you know Father Safai? Well, he's a pastor there. Oh, I know him well. He came from Malta. And then he embezzled lots of money from Malta, so I can go there.
Mm.
And then he went to see the Father Safai a second time. And he said, Father Safai, and when he saw me, he saw the John, my brother-in-law, and he turned blue, perfectly turned color.
Mm.
And there's no problem.
Mm.
As a penance, he had 40 minutes the sermon on race relationship that everybody has to listen to. And so that's what happened. But this John, the John Mikarev, my brother-in-law, passed away this March 26.
Mm.
He was the maintenance crew of Enola Gay.
Oh, he was?
And he even at the close to the, he was a pretty bad Alzheimer by as of last year even, he knew exact protocol how to disarm the nuclear bomb one by one.
Mm.
And the we used to tell them, you know, you can disarm the atomic bomb and yet you don't, you know, remember things that happened yesterday. But he always felt that that's kind of funny, because my brother-in-law was at the, you know, A-bomb, the victims, and I'm the one who is fixing the airplane. And so that was kind of interesting.
But you were able to talk about that?
Oh, yeah, we did talk about that quite a bit about it. And there
that
was
interesting.
There was with this group of people that they bombed a bombing squad called 449.
Mm-hmm.
They used to meet quite often every year in the group of a bombing squad that, including Enoroge. And the captain of the Lonely Lady was Dr. Cartwright, Tom Cartwright,
mm-hmm.
was professor of statistics at the Texas A&M.
Mm-hmm.
And he he and his group invited me to the group meeting in Detroit one time. They went to the Widowland factory site,
mm-hmm.
where they made the last B-29.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really interested to see how everything was connected. You know, the 6 degree of acquaintance.
Mm.
If you know six people, out of six people, you have some connections.
Mm. Mm. That is.
So,
and you never would have imagined even, you know, to have that person or connection within your
right.
extended family, right? Speaking of connections, do you know that there are more than one groups of survivors in the U.S. who get together and organize themselves so that they could be better recognized? They first came together in late 1960s in California, and then that was in Los Angeles, and they had a branch in San Francisco early in 1970s, and they became a survivors group, and then there are some, you know, splits later on. So actually one of the things that they did in 1970s, but also in early part of the 1980s, is to demand recognition by the U.S. government.
Ah.
Because there are people who were born in the States or Hawaii, and they were in Hiroshima for family reasons.
Yeah,
and then they happened to be affected by the bomb.
Yeah,
and then, of course, you
were.
Came back.
Yeah.
So they realized that, well, it's good to be recognized by the Japanese government, but we are American citizens, and just like the people
yeah,
that
I
you write
Yeah, I remember
reading
some
about.
Of these people. This is the 70th year's anniversary for that.
Mm-hmm.
And in many newspapers, and the like NHK International,
mm-hmm.
they had an interview with a lady who...
Yes. Yeah, and she's one of the leaders of those organizations
that
exist today. But you obviously didn't have any contact or connections with...
Because I was hiding. First of all, it's kind of interesting because most of the people that I see are the peace activists, very much peace activists. Survivors themselves.
Mm.
I have never heard the word saying, hey, you know, the Japan has to be worry about the safety of the security of the Japan itself, although world peace is important. But instead, we have to achieve the world peace, the peace forever, and the no nuclear. But I think it's very naive in that sense. I do not belong to any organization, so I was not being affected by anybody. But the more I started thinking about what's happened, as I mentioned to you in my brief comment, 2009, I went to Japan in April. And that was a day when North Korea shot the long-range missile across Japan,
mm-hmm.
and it went into the Pacific Ocean.
So mm-hmm. nervous about them being over there at that
yeah.
time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah.
And,
that's very understandable.
Yeah, every
yeah.
10 minutes or so, the NHK says, well, the North Korean missile is just passing over Niigata Prefecture, and passing over the someplace cities, and then, well, that whole thing, the Japanese people, my classmate too, did not really think that was a big issue. And he thought he was laughing about it. Well, I hope that they probably would not hit us. But I do not underestimate that, because if we can work with people who are logical and normal group of people, that's fine. But then these people are not really that normal, because their goal is to kill you. And if if the Jewish people think about the same way about the Iran. If the Iranians, so the the ultimate goal in life is to kill Jewish people, why do they have to say, well, let's have peace with them? And that, I think, is the things I still have kind of, I started getting that feeling more, much more intense now, because North Korea, Iran, and even Pakistan has a nuclear bomb.
So maybe you can tell me a little more in detail about why you describe yourself as a hiding or a hidden survivor. You said earlier that you feel as though many survivors, including survivors here, are peace activists, and I don't think it's true. And there are lots of people who are not peace activists who are also survivors. But regardless of that...
Well, I have to know about that, you know?
Yeah, but yeah. Why do you... Where does it come from that you are a survivor?
The thing is, I, being a Japanese origin, personality-wise, my telling other people I was there and I was exposed to the nuclear bomb probably would not give them much information. And if they have the information, what can they do about it? So my family knows, my few good friends knows about it. Well, that would be fine, but then I will not publicize myself as the victims and do about it in public, the organized fashions. And that's probably the reason why I was really hiding myself, but then I never volunteered that information to other people.
So you were not even aware of those existing
organizations? No, I don't know that those people.
Do you have any reactions or any immediate thought about how they struggle to be recognized by the U.S. government, as well as by the Japanese government? There are actually still ongoing lawsuits between U.S. survivors and Japanese government, because after 2003, U.S. survivors started to be recognized by the Japanese government, so they can get survivors' health benefit, for instance, and some monetary support. Not exactly on the same conditions as Japanese survivors, but up to a certain point.
Yeah.
So there is definitely increasing recognition by the Japanese government, but nothing at all by the U.S. government. And being a U.S. citizen, I mean, they tried to make a difference early on, but they were not successful. So to them, it's a disappointing history in that it was a time period when anti-nuclear, you know, movement was really on the rise, and yet they failed to be recognized.
What was the situation when the Truman, the President Truman said, even in 1954? After 10 years after he was 55, I think, he mentioned that it was a right choice, right decision to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that actually prevented many deaths of many Americans, and I think that whole thing was probably still major ideas of the American citizens. I don't think a percentage of people asking quick question about that is probably, I don't really see much difference now and in 1954.
You mean American people in general?
But for Japanese, you know, the first 10 years, I think General MacArthur had, as I mentioned, complete control of the media. And therefore, the media would never mention about a detail of the survivors and how that affect the whole societies. And so media control actually delayed the information to Japanese peoples. Even people who live in the northern part of Japan doesn't know about the nuclear bomb. It's a similar cases like in Fukushima. And Fukushima's disaster was actually the industrial disasters. And they knew that they should not build the reactor there, but they did. But these people did not know much about Hiroshima people. I think, you know, it was nice to know that the other people were doing something about it. And is there any statistics available that I can study. The thing that I am most worried about is how many of these victims or the victims' family are still suffering from the effect of the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it depends on how you define the effect of the bomb. So it could be very medically defined, but also it gets to include things like people really worrying about their future possibilities that may not be as, you know, bright and healthy as they hope them to be.
Right.
But also things like lack of recognition, I think it does count as a problem or maybe even suffering in people's lives in that you witnessed this and then you affected it, but nobody wants to say, yes, you are.
That's true, because the stigma is attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, but this year, I'm you know, really glad that the victims of Korean peoples, they were now recognized by Prime Minister Abe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was very nice. But is that the monument is still outside the park, or is it allowed to put the monument inside the park? And I think that was very bad for the, if the Japan want to live as a good neighbor to the neighboring countries, they should come out and saying, I'm sorry, this was not supposed to be done that way, and then bring these, you know, people back into the park. It doesn't cost much to the people.
Mm-hmm.
And the even for the comfort lady stuff, that the issues of the comfort lady in Korea, the Japanese government, instead of doing the revising a textbook and things like that, they should come out and say, that was a mistake we have made in the past, and they say, well, I'm sorry, to apologize to you people. And not to justify. And I think it's very important, but they haven't done that.
How about the U.S. government? Is there anything that U.S. government should be doing in your perception?
You know, it's interesting. U.S. government should be or should not be doing, because it's a war. The life in the, like in an insurance company, war is not counted as an event. Even the pollution the controls, the war is not counted as a part of the pollution. But I think the U.S. government, what the U.S. government have to do is to work with Japanese government, try to keep that, you know, even the small part of the world, keep a bit peace, you know, peace and safe, because that I think is most important than giving compensation to the people. You know, talking about what has happened in the past will not bring back anything. Probably the monetary compensation, no. If you recognize, so what? However, though, on the basis of the knowledge, if you can keep the world much peaceful and much safer to live, it is not idealistic, but they should really work on that. But
do you think the future planning would be possible if you do not think about the past? Meaning the people who...
I don't think people have never learned from the past. You know, if we learned from the past, the World War II would never happen. World War I was so tragic war. The people never learned. And any other wars, the European have many wars, they never learned. And for that reason, if the people learn from the past, they'll be fine. But then, being historians, probably the reason for you to study history is to learn something from the past. But probably, I'm very pessimistic maybe, but if you look at the history, probably does the people learn from that? I'm not so sure about it. This is one of the things that the human nature, the being aggressive nature in some place, it's different from orangutans or the gorilla. They even have a war themselves, but you know, human probably would not learn anything typically from the past mistake we made.
To me, just talking with people who are very much affected by the bomb and still remembers a lot about their experiences.
Yes.
The bomb is not really the past. They are still living.
It's every day. You know, it's interesting. I had the nightmare up until even when I was married to my wife, and she used to wake me up because I had this, because we have to run fast enough. And so those nightmares were true, but maybe my personality or something, my life becomes so busy, my degree and postdoc and the company life. And so actually, I have a nightmare actually eventually went away.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, but it doesn't bother me much.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Do you think of anything, or can you think of anything that you do, or you think, or you say, because of your experience of the bomb? In other words, I guess I'm wondering if there is anything that was being shaped in significant way, one way or another, by your experience of the bomb that might have an effect even today.
By my experience, actually, the war, if the war cannot be avoided, at least the people have to really learn how to live with it, and for people, you know, daily life-wise, so that if you can live with, you know, the 70th time zone, the destructive power of the earth, that is something that you have to live in the beginning now. And so you'll be killed, but if you activate the whole thing, each other will start killing each other so fast that probably Earth will be gone. The people, the human being, probably were gone within about 3 hours. And so, you know, that's my experience says, okay, we're not supposed to do this. We're not supposed to have nuclear bomb. You have to ban it. But is that realistic? If somebody comes here and I'm going to drop the atomic bomb on your head again, would you like to prevent it? Or would you like to accept it? And that's what I usually ask my friends. And Japanese says, well, you have to prevent these people to dropping it. But then, I don't think it happens. So, in a sense that I think we have to be always aware of that, you know. It's not say one person's effort to really stop the war, but we have to have the world without the war. And so, you know, if there is any kind of rogue countries that they say their national goal is to annihilate XYZ countries, and that whole thing is, that has a really dangerous thought that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you can actually solve this as historians, but I think that probably will happen, that we have to think about how to prevent war before, way before it happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was going to high school, you remember Mr. Rutz? You remember the history
teacher
that was there?
Yeah.
I don't know what his job was. I think he was probably working as an intelligence officer on the side. You know, very unusual guy. But one thing he taught us in class, you know, because there was still tension at that time. It wasn't Cold War. The Berlin Wall had not fallen. And what he said was that mutually assured destruction is the only way to keep the world peace. That was what we were taught in school, was that mutually assured destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And he explained it. You know, if I have a stick and another person has a bigger stick, you're probably not going to pick on the guy with the bigger stick. In fact, we had a thing that we called the shaft. He broke one, so he had a second one. It was made out of walnut about this big. But that's his teaching method.
Mm-hmm.
That was the philosophy of the time,
mm-hmm.
was that, you know, mutually assured destruction,
mm-hmm.
is going to keep the world peace.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no other way to really manage that. And he says, and that's why you won't have another major war like they had during World War II.
Mm-hmm. So I think one thing that people have done, including U.S. survivors, they have done organizing work so that they won't be just talking about, let's say, better recognition for survivors or more support for, let's say, medical research to find out what health effect that might happen in long term. And those are investment that could happen in part or large part because people come together. And that's actually what happened for survivors in the 70s, and that was actually in collaboration with the groups of civil rights activists who are Asian Americans. So as you might have heard, back in 1960s and 70s, civil rights movement was very active, actively conducted in Asian American communities, including people who are as young as college students, but also older people as well. By then, survivors here were older, so they were not college students, but they were in their 40s and 50s in many ways. I should say 30s and 40s, many of them anyway. But have you ever heard of Asian American civil rights movement that was really huge in around the time that you were studying, you know, in college?
No, no. That was kind of interesting that this should have. Whenever I go to Los Angeles, I go to that the Japanese American National Museum, and their concentration is the internment camps.
Yes.
If you look at this, and they have civil movement in Watts areas in Los Angeles. Their remarks is much more different from the black people in Los Angeles about this racial harmonies in the United States. So I thought about that was very important to have that kind of unities among the Asians, because whenever the people talk about the civil movement, racial equality, race relationship, they're talking about between white and black. And not other people in between, Asians and Indians and other the so-called non-white. Instead, the African American versus, so that it's interesting. When you put the minority, you have to put non-Latinos. You have to put in medical forms. It's a very funny things. You have to put your race, and are you American? They are African Americans, Caucasians, and then. The so-called non-Latin, I thought it's a very much funny way of classifying people, but those things are the one that causes the discrimination. In the government forms, HIPAA forms, they already have this, and the same government and try to achieve the racial harmonies, and I think that is not really, you know, correct myself.
Now, I know you have been answering many questions, and I know maybe you're getting tired a little bit, so I'd like to ask you a few remaining questions. So maybe you can tell me a little bit about the project that you told me earlier, which is about this the prisoner of war who were serving the U.S. Army and captured and then happened to be affected by the bomb. And I'd like to know where your interest is coming from. Obviously, you're a survivor, so you're interested in this issue. But you also earlier described to me
you
are a hidden survivor, hiding survivor. But in some ways, it sounds like you are coming out.
Well, I tell you, I have nothing to hide, actually. I'll be candid as I can. And I think it's important for me to tell people what's happened. But my feeling is, it really doesn't really help anybody else. I hope that does. Some people who organize things, yes, the experience will, sharing experience will help somebody else's way. In my, you know, in my feeling, it's not. Instead, I spend most of my time in getting more harmony between scientists and the non-scientist. And because I was in industry for 45 years, and past 12 years as the vice president of research at the Neogen in Lansing. And I see so many scientists doesn't know a thing about business. And the businessman doesn't want to know about science. So this particular two different words mm-hmm. is the one that is causing the issues in the societies. The understanding of science, what the nuclear bomb does, and the scientists knew what's happening. But Roosevelt did not know much about it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
if it kills 200,000 people in 1 second, hey, let's do it. And that type of mentality still exists in any societies now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why I went to a business school and took my MBA.
Mm-hmm.
And also I was testing my brain. Because most of my friends who retired and don't do anything, that actually rapidly deteriorated. And by competing in a mm-hmm. business school environment,
mm-hmm.
young people, and see how I can cope with this. And actually I really feel much, much more confident than these people who are staying home. And so that's what I did. And perhaps I'm probably using my time more positive way of teaching the graduate student in the engineering,
mm-hmm.
try to develop the biosensors and to make it into what sellable materials.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, if you look at the engineering school, they don't teach you how practical it is. Indeed, professors don't want to tell students to make something practical. They
mm-hmm.
think it's something bad. It says, no, you have to have, if you're going to make something,
mm-hmm.
you have to make something practical.
Mm.
And that's why I'm doing now, teaching the biosensors.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, this biosensor is so different that you can pick up nerve gas for military use much earlier than you get killed.
Mm.
The current sensor that we have on the market, by the time you know there is a nerve gas, you're dead.
Mm.
So that's one of the interesting philosophy that I have. You have to defend yourself and aggressively defend yourself.
And that is related to your work on this book, do you think?
This book is, I was pulled in almost. Because Mr. Moore and I used to play a lot in my junior high and high school times.
Mm-hmm.
And
he teaches at a Japanese university now?
Did you mention? No, he does. He's kind of an interesting guy. He has never been a Catholic. He married a Catholic woman because he was selling piano for Yamaha Piano.
I see.
And Mrs. Moore is a very good, the ardent Catholic, and her daughter Tamami is also a very strong Catholic. And however, I didn't know that when he married, because I was in this country at that time. And however, he was very close to my parents, because since I'm there, in this country, so my parents almost adopted him as their kid.
Mm.
So he used to dropped in my house a lot,
mm-hmm.
and so I used to hear from him and from my parents about his activities. And that's why I say, Sato, you have to help me this.
Mm.
So I started writing letters to the survivors' families.
Mm.
In the first couple of years, I've been diffused because it's what the heck is this, you know, the funny Japanese writing to me about dead relatives of mine. There must
mm-hmm.
be something.
Mm-hmm.
But then, one day.
So you mean not survivors' families, but POWs families. Yeah.
And so, the Dr. Cartwright was the only one that survived,
mm-hmm.
because he was sent to Tokyo,
mm-hmm.
and while he's in Tokyo being interrogated, his crew member died in.
I see.
Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm.
So then I contacted with Dr. Cartwright, and he was very nice to me. He accepted our invitation to start conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So he worked with other relatives, so
mm-hmm.
the
mm-hmm.
POWs.
Uh-huh.
And then from that point, you get lots of information.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the meantime, Japanese and U.S. government actually released some of the so-called classified documents,
uh-huh.
names of the POWs,
mm-hmm.
and their rankings and things like that. So that's the whole thing that he wrote this book.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, because of the 70th anniversary, President Truman's grandson is in the media industries.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to make the, he's now making the documentary movies.
Mm-hmm. He seems to be very active in, you know, investigating the history of the bomb.
Yes.
And yes, I know some other people who works with him.
Yes.
So that's interesting that his name comes up in your comment as
yes,
well.
Yes,
yeah.
That's one of the things that, you know, it's interesting. If you, when we were a kid in the near Ayabashi, there was the three shadows that the people who were watching the bomb to be, you know, exploding. And these three people evaporated
mm-hmm.
and left the shadow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, shadow is getting little by little, you know, less and less.
Mm-hmm.
And one shadow is in Hiroshima in the bank, a staircase of the bank. There was another shadow that is disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I see this, when somebody was exposed to that, you know, 6 to 7,000 Fahrenheit, your body instantaneously evaporates. And so probably that is kindest way to kill somebody else if you're going to kill. But does it really justify it? Because I have this means to kill somebody in the most kindest way in 1 second. I don't think it's the way to do that.
And it happens only at the very nearby area of hypocenter. It just changes the way that people die.
The United States was doing 2 experiments. One is a uranium bomb in Hiroshima, and then the other one is a plutonium bomb. And scientists are very much interested in knowing which bomb does the more damage. And that probably is one of the unconscionable way of using people as a target to test your own weapons.
Now, you are also a scientist yourself, but also you make some comments about scientists just like you did just now, which seems to be critical as well as thinking about science from inside perspective. Could you please tell me a little more about it? You being a scientist and then sort of thinking about the science.
The group of scientists, was for the peace or something, scientist group that was conscience. And, all these scientists in the Manhattan Project were very well-known scientists, physicists, the mathematicians, engineers. And yet, they were interested in scientific results rather than what the effect of the science would be. In the same way, genetic engineering is the same way that if you can manipulate the genes, you can actually bring a huge benefit to the human being. And yet, if you make mistakes, like you can synthesize, you can, in the lab, you can virtually from bits by bit make a virus that nobody have no resistance to. And something like that, scientists should know what would have the impact on people before they engage into their research. The polio vaccines,
mm-hmm.
the polio viruses, you're going to rejuvenate the polio viruses now, or the black, the black mm-hmm. death, and that I think is the scientists have to have, they always have some, idea about what would be the impact of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And
you were saying that the Manhattan scientists probably didn't think that much about the impact part. Is that what you're saying?
Most of the people, if you look at the science, the areas, even the small university like MSU, they perish or publish, or publish or perish. That thing happens. Whatever the consequence is, if you have some real hot concept, you probably have to have some idea, and then maybe you may sacrifice your career for not publishing it. But do
mm-hmm.
you do this? There's an interesting professor, probably Jim Trosko.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Hijiyama in ABCC in 1992, way after I was the... But he and I shared the all sorts of interesting the discussion with similar concept, because being a scientist, we share the same idea. The kind of scientist should have the, you know, they always think about what the consequence would be.
Speaking of that, this is probably something that I should have or could have asked you earlier, but when you were still in Japan and living lives years after the war was over, did you have any contact with the ABCC?
No. ABCC usually, how they did was, they have those people's names, the list of names from hospitals and social workers in the town. They preferentially picked those people who went to the hospitals, so that you know, for that reason,
you were not picked up.
I was not physically damaged, and you know, I was not in as real close to the epicenters or burnt. Probably I have been exposed to the radiation, but it was very difficult for them to assess it anyhow. So for that reason, I was not chosen. But yeah, many of my friends in the school were chosen to go to Hijiyama and the being that they studied. And
did a car come to your school to pick up your friends?
Yeah, some jeep used to come, and you know, in actually, this happened late elementary school and also that the junior high. But you know, Noborimachi is a place where they have Sadako's, you know, monuments is there, and Sadako was one of the graduates from that same school.
I see.
And so, you know, that's one of the things people look at it, and but students in particular like it so much. Yes, because, you know, it's ironical, because when I went to St. Paul's, I was the first or second year student that was able to handle radioactive elements and how to use this. And I always thought, gee, this is very the kind of ironic, because, and I'm glad that I did, because that I learned lots of techniques there.
So. That's right. Now, you already told me a lot, but also at the same time, I feel like whatever, however much effort I make, I can get to hear only very small part of people's experiences, but I do appreciate that you made time to tell me what you told me. But is there, I'm wondering if there is anything that you hope to say to me. I ask my questions and you tell me your stories, but again, the interaction doesn't capture everything.
Well, then I have a question to you is, obviously you're much younger than me and probably do you, the reason why you get into, do you have any personal relationship with some the your relatives or somebody that has been?
No, I do not have any personal relationship. I am from that area. My family is from Hiroshima area originally, and that's where my family grave is still located. And my father was maybe in a similar situation as yours. Went to a school in the countryside of Hiroshima, even though he, before the wars, was living in Kobe. And he and his mother went to this country of Hiroshima. And I think my grandmother remembers seeing the mushroom cloud from where she was, although she was not in the city in any sense of the word. So she was not affected by the bomb. But this is part of the family story that I was told as I was growing up. And I guess just growing up in Japan, I was exposed to much information about the bomb. I mean, much not in a sense that was enough or sufficient, but much in a sense compared to what American children might have been exposed, which is not that much, about the history of the bomb. And then also exposed to the bomb literature. Literature was very deeply... yeah, it was something that I remember even as I became older. So I guess I was always interested in issues of the bomb. But as a U.S. historian, there was not much immediate connection. But then when I realized that there are people who are living with the bomb in America, as many of them being American citizens, having this fascinating history of belonging to both Japan and America, I thought that I have to know more about those people. So that's where my interest is from.
That's good. Good luck with your project, and you eventually going to make it into a book.
Yeah, that's what historians do. We write books and sometimes articles as well.
Yes, but
books are
in your. I was wondering, do you? So they have time. Do you ever wonder why Japanese have a hard time to make decisions? Because when I'm teaching business schools and business-oriented students, one of the characteristics of Japanese companies or the organization is they don't make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And recently I led, you know, for the medical part of it. Interesting thing, the Japanese is most pessimistic people. And they have the largest population of people who has the short form of the gene that transfer the dopamine. So dopamine transfer protein. And the longer the dopamine receptor gene is longer, you're optimistic. And the most, the largest population that have the long form is the African and South Pacific. Americans is about 10 times higher than the Japanese. Japanese, on the other hand, short form, most pessimistic, the form, and most people have in Japan have the short form of the dopamine transfer protein. That for that reason, brain thinks that you can't afford make the mistake. So that's one of the things. I was wondering whether you have studied something like this. It was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't directly study it, but in my opinion, as a historian, I do not agree with biological determinism. I think, actually, I teach many pre-med students in one of the joint departments I teach in, and they are science majors.
Yes.
And one thing that they are really recently trained in science courses, but also in history of medicine science courses that I teach, is that it goes both ways, nature and nurture, to put it simply. So when I hear stories like that, you know, difference between Americans and Japanese, my inclination is, in response to your question, is to say that I do not think that Japanese people have difficulty in making decisions. I think what counts as decision differs from a culture to another.
That's true.
Yeah.
But don't they more perfectionist? And they, because, you know, one time, that was about 2 years ago, I was invited to a friend of mine's at the high school. There was about 300 students in my the talk I gave. I mentioned that the student, you don't have to be perfect. You can be B plus and maybe the 80% is just fine. Enjoy your life when you're young, because the perception of life is so different. And the principal said, I don't want to talk to my student in the same way, because we perceive to be perfect. You know, we don't want to see anybody less than the perfect. So 100% is okay, but 99 is not okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine, but I'm sorry I mentioned that. But are they happy? Well, she said, no, it doesn't matter, as long as they can go to the university. And that's one of the interesting experiences I had.
Mm-hmm.
They are really perfectionist.
Mm-hmm. I think the societal expectations and institutions and sorts of things that are around them are going to affect them very much, and then they continue to do so. So I think that's
the same
a big
way
part
the
of the
Americans are
yeah.
C plus is okay. So that's one of the things that I thought is very interesting.
So thank you very much again.
Thank you.
For both of you.
And
both of you. And I will, like I said earlier, I'm going to send you a copy of this signed form. and you know where to find me.
Okay, PDF is fine.
Uh-huh,
and
that sounds good.
I'd like to hear this when the publications
yeah.
come out.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to hear about your publication.
Yes. Sure.
And also, if there's anything I can help you in your lectures or teaching, let me know.
Yeah,
perhaps some of these medical students might like to hear my views and things like that too,
mm-hmm.
then
mm-hmm.
I'd be very happy to do that.
That's a very generous offer on your part. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will consider
okay.
that.
Okay, good.